great. Welcome back to the Opioid Epidemic Network. My name is Larissa. I'll be your host today. And today I'm joined with Dr. Allie Burns. Dr. Allie Burns is the president and CEO of Hope House Addiction Services and the president of End Massachusetts Overdose. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Burns.
Thank you for having me.
We've been wanting to chat with you for a little bit now, so we're very excited that you're on the show today, especially because of the prominent work that you do within Massachusetts and within the South End near Boston Medical Center. Let's start off with a little bit of your background. You do have a very interesting background, and something about the Naval Academy, and then being a pharmacist, and then, you know, getting all the way to being a CEO. Tell us more.
So, different background, a different route to pharmacy of sorts. So I originally started in the Navy. I graduated from the Naval Academy. I was commissioned by President Obama and went into the pilot program. And in the pilot program, within my first 2 years as an officer, I was injured. And during that time, I was stationed in Florida, 2008, 2009. A lot of not good prescribing across the country, but I was pretty much in the OxyContin highway of Florida. And so I ended up having two surgeries and doing my physical rehabilitation, you know, all that, all the PT at the VA. And it really bothered me because I saw my fellow, like, sailors and Marines. I saw people becoming addicted to these pain pills. And it really hit me one day when I went into PT, and one of the guys, we'd always joke around together, and he had overdosed. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't raise our hand to come back here and die. We raised our hand to go serve our country. So at that point, I had approached the Navy because at this point, I have no transferable skills. I was never going to be able to fly again, and then was later diagnosed with avascular necrosis and lost my ability to walk. So the big Navy told me that I could go to pharmacy school, which ended up, you know, I really wanted to figure out what was going on with these medications and why this was affecting the people around me. Mm-hmm. And then at pharmacy school, I continued to see this uptick. So now I went from Florida to Massachusetts. So I've gone all the way up the Eastern Seaboard. And I'm like, wow, it's not changing. Because at first I'm like, maybe it's a Southern thing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a Navy thing. Now I'm seeing it all over the place. And now I'm seeing it in, you know, my home state of Massachusetts, up and down the coast of Massachusetts. So I did the capstone and created End Mass Overdose. And the whole premise of that was to get Narcan out, so naloxone, out to the community so people had the tools to reverse an overdose. Mm-hmm. That was the point of it. And then it quickly grew into more than that. The Department of Public Health and Bureau of Substance Addiction Services approached me, and I became a pharmacist consultant for the state because it was the first time that they also had seen this opioid epidemic. Drugs have always existed. There's always been drug problems throughout all of human civilization. Yeah. There's such things called the opium wars and everything else. Yeah. It's not like that has changed. But what did change is the advent of prescription pills and OxyContin and the effect that that had on addiction and the way we've now looked at addiction, because before you would get something from a drug dealer of sorts, or maybe even a doctor, but usually, for lack of a better word, a shady one. And now you have people who really aren't trying to do harm, and they're causing severe patient harm. So they really wanted to get a pharmacist involved, which was wonderful from the state's perspective that they were that forward-thinking to see, okay, there's experts that know about how to diagnose and how to treat, and then there's experts that know about just, like, the medication and what that does to the body, not really what it's doing to the disease state or anything else, but what it does to the body and to the mind. Mm-hmm. And so I got involved with it that way, and then that quickly grew. This is funny, actually. I don't know if anybody really knows this. So I ended up at Hope House because I was handing out blankets. That was one of the things, like, blankets and Narcan. And it was the coldest day. If you ask Fred Newton, who was my predecessor, it was the coldest day of the year. I remember. It was December 15th. I was still not walking. I was on a device that So I didn't know if I was going to need an amputation at the time, but it was something that you could almost like hook your leg in and allowed you to learn how to walk on what would be similar to if you had an amputation to get ready for it mentally. It's a great thing that they actually do with the VA. Mm-hmm. But I ended up not having that. So I'm on that, and I'm like on my little, they called it my peg leg because that's what it looked like. And I'm trying to give out stuff at December 15th in 2016. And Fred Newton, like right around the corner from where I'm now, he walked around to go get a coffee. And he was with his, one of the directors. And he's like, who is this small little girl trying to hand out blankets? She should not be out here. It's not safe. Mind you, now she's seeing like swarms of people, of course, in the middle of Methadone Mile on the corner of Mass Ave and Melnia Cass. And he's like, who are you? What are you doing? Oh, you're a pharmacist. I run the oldest addiction program in Massachusetts, and I had no idea what Hope House was. So it was incorporated in the 60s. Mm-hmm. It's the oldest and now the largest, or among the largest, in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So we have 95 in what you would consider an inpatient beds. We have 95 beds. Okay. 16 of those are co-occurring, 22 single-room occupancy, and then another 24 graduate beds, all for men who suffer from addiction, or people who identify as men. And then we also have a very bustling outpatient. We have probably over 200 visits a week. That's both men and women, but we're rapidly expanding. But long story short, he's like, Fred's like, I'm on the opioid task force for the governor. That he was went on it in 2015. He goes, something's wrong with these meds. Mm-hmm. And I've got a lot of guys. And he had never seen this before. He's worked in addiction. So like I said, when I started, we had people, they were on methadone. Mm-hmm. That was it. That's all we had. He's like, I have guys that are 30 years old, and they're on 18 meds a day, and I have no clue what's going on. I don't know what this is. Can you come help me? So I come over, and I never left, and so I took over. So I took over for Fred and became the CEO, president CEO of Hope House this past summer. So we're rapidly expanding now because we are obviously trying to meet the needs of the state, but... Yeah.
Congratulations, though.
Yeah, thank you.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
When you started End Mass Overdose, you said that the Narcan access was your main goal, mm-hmm. but then you also said that it's expanding. So what is End Mass Overdose doing today?
So End Mass Overdose today, funny, you should ask, it's very much morphed into its own thing. It's really... If anybody needs advice out there and wants to do a business plan ever, you've got to be adaptable and flexible with the times and really focus on what are you trying to give. If you're trying to help people, you've got to help what their needs are exactly at that moment, be able to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. So it went from the Narcan and doing Narcan trainings mm-hmm. and getting Narcan out to the public to training prescribers and nurses about originally like how to co-prescribe Narcan. And because everybody was like, well, when do you co-prescribe it? Are they going to think that we're stigmatizing them by saying they should use this? Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of just, you know, stigma and a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. People have legitimate questions. Like, well, I don't want to offer Narcan because then they're going to think that I think they're a drug addict. Or the other side of it is, well, I'm not offering that because it's a free pass and it will increase. There's these concepts that, you know, if Narcan's free for addicts, this should be free somebody else. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's not really the problem. I think when I see these things that are like that, it's, you know, it has nothing to do with the Narcan. We're really upset about the drug prices of other things. Let's focus on that. But so now today what we do is medication therapy management. Okay. But it's almost an enhanced form. It's specialized specifically in mental health and substance use disorders, mm-hmm. which is very tricky in itself because how do you treat people with medications that these are very high-risk individuals that also have very high co-occurring mental illness? They could take all of them at one point to get high or to also have a suicide risk. Mm-hmm. So we have, it's a balance there and a lot of behavioral interventions mixed in. So we specialize in that and really I call it just medication management services and interventions where a pharmacist comes in and we do mostly residential facilities, but it's helping them manage their medications, review everything for any interactions. Mm-hmm. Again, that no one knows somebody's at the methadone clinic at like a CVS, but we really act more than a medical home here. Plus, a lot of people don't know, substance use disorder programs are subject to much stricter laws. So HIPAA is like our floor. We are 42 CFR Part 2, mm-hmm. which is so much more protective than HIPAA. Sometimes it's like you can almost not laugh at him, but you're like, oh, no, no, that's not how that works. I mean, I can't even confirm. Someone calls here, and they were here yesterday visiting somebody. We can't call her. You can't even confirm or deny the person's still here. Hmm. Well, you don't know that person. It's very, very, very protected to protect people from the stigmatizing of substance use disorders. It actually way predates HIPAA. It goes back to the 70s. So it started in the 70s. So it's very difficult for people to share information because you need so many releases of information. So it's sometimes, you know, can't point fingers either way. There's regulatory reasons. There's also just electronic processes and health systems that don't integrate. And so really being in a residential setting is where you really get to get down to the nuts and bolts of helping these individuals. So we do the medication services and consultation. The other big thing that we do is a lot of education. So we expanded from Narcan to we do everything. So we go to places where we will teach them all about medication-assisted treatment.
Okay.
We do antidepressants, antipsychotics, pretty much anything around the behavioral health and mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And what does this look like? Mixing them all together. So we do a lot of continuing education, a lot of medication consultation and services.
Mm-hmm.
And our most recent contract that we got with the state is dealing with medication errors or discrepancies. So we'll be deployed when something is sent into DPH. They will analyze it there, and then if a consultation or site visit is needed in their plan of correction, we'll be sent out as an unbiased third party to go and evaluate it, give them our recommendations, and then it would go into licensing. So
that's amazing.
It's exciting.
Wow.
It's good times. I like that it's not, I feel like usually when there's an audit or an inspection, we're always like, ooh, it's punishment, or there's so much negative that goes with it, but now it's really to help.
Yeah.
It's really to protect people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's to protect health and wellness. So it's good. It's a good change.
Yeah. You mentioned mental illness treatment and substance use treatment being a tricky subject to broach. So do you notice that most of the treatments are very patient specialized, or do you feel like there could be a protocol that comes out of this?
So I think there's a couple reasons why I think this is tricky.
Sure.
So when we're looking at things, you get an ear infection, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know exactly, there's a gold standard, this is what you take,
yeah.
And it typically works. Everybody, if this doesn't work, there's a treatment failure, the infection's not cured, you move on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that typically works for everybody, you know? Unless you're a pediatric, you had your weight-based. But still, it's usually the same active ingredient. There's guidelines, and they're important to have. However, mental health must be very individualized.
Mm-hmm.
It's also not something where you can just take a medication and it's better.
Mm-hmm.
Medications, as I always tell my patients, bring you halfway. You have to change what's going on. The medications are just for them when they're, I deal very, very either moderate to severe mentally ill patients. I want these medications to calm you down or to recenter you, whatever you need, so now we can work on the hard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because that doesn't cure, the medication, the antidepressant doesn't cure the childhood trauma. It doesn't cure the sexual abuse,
mm-hmm.
the physical abuse, the emotional neglect, all these things. It doesn't touch those. And so medication, a lot of times, some people I see, they get frustrated. It's like, well, I tried this and it worked and now it doesn't work anymore. But there was no behavioral or mental health therapy or psychosocial therapy that went along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that what got lost in it is we always thought just traditional counseling. Traditional counseling, 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 counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody go to counseling. And there's never enough counseling appointments. And then they're never covered by insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody is different. And not everybody, talk therapy is great, but not everybody is at the number one thing for them. So always start at a baseline.
Mm-hmm.
But in that talk therapy, what you're really supposed to do is to figure out what are these underlying issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then do behavior modification and then find more healthier ways to express. So sometimes it's through talk therapy that you figure out, hey, they really could benefit from art therapy, music therapy, yoga, mindfulness, trauma-informed, gender-informed, culturally informed, and it's, you have to get them more into that individualized, because there's a, everybody experiences something different, mm-hmm. right? It's very different than other disease states. So it's, to say it's like individualized, it's so much that goes into it. And for a traditional doctor, like a psychiatrist, you don't have that much time in our system right now to do that. It takes a whole treatment team. Mm-hmm. It just does. So it's very difficult. And then you change. Mm-hmm. So now there's these things, like now we have like super bugs. Maybe that's the only thing that could be like this. And you're like, what do we do when amoxicillin doesn't work anymore? Mm-hmm. But you figure it out, right? Or you quarantine the person, I guess. Well, we can't quarantine people who are mentally ill. That doesn't work, okay? That's not where we're going with this. So, you know, what happens when what's working doesn't work anymore? That's the challenge in mental health mm-hmm. and in substance abuse. Especially substance abuse. So you can definitely see it now. Before, maybe 5 years ago, I would hear people, what's your first drug of choice? Oxycontin, now it's heroin because it became too expensive, or the supply didn't, it wasn't available, it was inaffordable, it was inaccessible, whatever. And they always stuck to those types of, you know, CNS depressants. Now, my guys are, my first drug of choice is heroin, my second is methamphetamine. That is two very different highs. Mm. Two very different highs. Mm-hmm. So it's not the high. It is the escape from something, whether it's reality, self-image, self-worth, lack of purpose, something. Mm-hmm. So we get so focused on that what and not the why. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why the drug treatment and the overall plan with the substance abuse also very individualized. And who you are at 18 isn't probably the person you are at 30, mm-hmm. who you are at 40 or 50. Your life goals change, your friends change, your environment change, and that's also what's difficult. Because if I get an ear infection at 18 and 22 mm-hmm. or 30, I'm probably going to take the same medication.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly probably not going to do the same thing if it's substance use mm-hmm. or mental health. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to adapt. And it's hard to figure that out with somebody. Mm-hmm. Hard. And then you add in, what is a, this is where it gets very tricky. What do you do when it's a substance-induced psychosis, a substance-induced depression, a substance-induced presentation that looks like bipolar disorder? Everyone coming off methamphetamine could probably be diagnosed with bipolar. We have a lot of people who come in with diagnoses, mm-hmm. and we ask, you know, when were you diagnosed? We have a nurse practitioner, and we have a whole staff. So we have a mm-hmm. doctor of pharmacy, we have the nurse practitioner, we have psychologists, and they all, from their own individual, and the social workers, too. Mm-hmm. It's very important to get that in there.
Yes.
You put them all in, they're all able to value person and give their input.
Mm-hmm.
From their perspective, their different disciplines, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you see, oh, I was diagnosed with bipolar in my 10th detox.
Mm-hmm.
Well, granted, yes, you've been detoxed 10 times. But every time you're coming down off of very, very psychoactive medications or drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone can really look off the wall when you're coming off of heroin or cocaine or crack or meth. Bath salts now, we've got the designer drugs. So you, and there's post-acute withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Your body is adapting mm-hmm. as you are not using drugs anymore. So remember, most drugs or substances that are abused work on dopamine. Mm-hmm. That's one of the main neurotransmitters.
Mm-hmm.
So when you remove that, you don't have as much dopamine in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So is the depression really exacerbated right now because you're in the first early months of recovery?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it long-standing? That is almost impossible to figure out. You have to just work with the person. And it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And then, is there a misdiagnosis?
Because mm-hmm.
they've always presented a certain way because they've always been someone with alcoholism. Mm-hmm. They actually aren't angry. They're just angry when they drink.
Yeah.
Or there's all these things that mm-hmm. it's a lot
mm-hmm.
to put into a treatment plan.
Yeah.
The treatment plan has to be really, I wouldn't say flexible, so it should be very structured, but structured and patient-specific. Mm-hmm. It should constantly be reevaluated. Mm-hmm. That's what it should be. Mm-hmm. It should always get input from at least one discipline. Mm-hmm. Must, because you've got to think differently. Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that you mentioned was that this is, you know, you're a different person at 18 than you are perhaps at 30.
Mm-hmm.
And then perhaps at 50 you have different life goals. I think for the listeners that are wondering, you know, what exactly substance use, how long we're looking at substance use for perhaps a patient or someone that's around you that's directly or indirectly affected, what you're really saying is this is a chronic lifelong disease.
Yes, I think there's a lot of controversy around mm-hmm. disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say, I'm like, it's a chronic condition. Okay. It fits the definition. Because, you know, some people are like, it's a choice, it's a disease.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you think the first time they did it, it was a choice. Other people say there's genetic factors. At the end of the day, we can all agree it is a condition that mm-hmm. affects the health, right? Mm-hmm. It's a condition. And it is a chronic condition.
Mm-hmm.
It affects all the other systems in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And even worse so, it is something that affects the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing when you have something, you know, a disorder that, you know, might affect maybe a limb,
mm-hmm.
right? But you still can able, you can think straight.
Yeah.
When you're not clear, you don't make the best health or life decisions anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So, That adds a little bit more difficulty.
That makes sense. Yeah, yeah. No, that clarifies it.
Yeah.
So I have my next question for you is, you were mentioning how every single patient is very, very specialized, and every patient needs the attention of, as you're saying here, you have four different specialties. Mm-hmm. Nurse practitioner, pharmacist, psychologist, social worker. To look at every single one of these patients, and you said you have 95 inpatient beds and 22 single rooms, how do you manage all of this at Hope House?
So, the way that we manage it here
mm-hmm.
is the best way to do it is really to standardize the procedures and the policies and the protocols.
Mm-hmm.
So every single person, the day they come through, day one, they all get the same standard of treatment and quality of care. So it means we have really in-depth, I've worked to really take generic treatment plans and make them so they better fit this mm-hmm. patient population. So what I mean is, yes, is it a standard form? Absolutely. But that standard form has a lot of questions that you would not see in other medical disciplines mm-hmm. or in other behavioral health disciplines even.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very different. Mm-hmm. And so there's questions and there's all this information that's then inputted. And so the way we manage it is then we take that information and we use that information to dictate the individual part of the treatment plan.
Mm-hmm.
Every single person is going to complete a psychosocial in the beginning mm-hmm. where we're going to try to get that information and then put the pieces together.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to go into phase one. So this is what we do. We have four phases. So phase one is a structured outpatient addiction program, and they go to 4 hours of groups in the morning and one in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're somebody that's already diagnosed with a co-occurring mental illness, we have the first integrated program in Massachusetts where that afternoon group, one is for the co-occurring track where it's more based on mental health things. So maybe they need to learn more about the anger management and emotion regulation and that,
mm-hmm.
versus the other side that might not have that, or at least not as severe,
mm-hmm.
and they need to know about how to find a job, how to figure out self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got two different things.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go to phase two, and phase two is all about, well, before this was a working house, so again, I came in with a much different view of how to really treat addiction,
because
mm-hmm. I think every way that we used to probably treat it before is outdated.
Okay.
So came in, I said, we revamped phase two. It used to be a working program. What that means, you had to get out into society. And I get the concept of get out into society, get a job, you know, be a productive member society. Totally understand that. What do you do for the people on SSDI? Mm-hmm. They can't work anymore. What do you do for the disabled people? What do you do for, and maybe this was my, when I lost my ability to walk, and I was like, well, what do you do for the people that can't physically actually go outside?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? What do you do for the guy that 60 overdoses, has hypoxic brain injury, or the guy that injected cocaine and had a stroke? What do you do for them?
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing here? So I revamped it, and now it's called LEAP. And so it's called LEAP for Learning Employment Advancement Program. And this part is all about just finding purpose. And this is a very big part of this type of specialty treatment. So it's either you're either going back to school,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's a vocational program. Maybe you were always a carpenter, or you always worked in construction, you always got hurt, and that's how you always got back into the pain pills, and that's just, you really should not go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you were a cook, and you always worked in the social or hospitality industry, and there's a lot of alcohol, and you're an alcoholic. Maybe that is not the best place for you. Or you were a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go back to your way of life, but you don't know anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all about, you know, we first work on their inner part in phase one and phase two, then we really start focusing on what are you going to do when to find yourself and
mm-hmm.
repurpose yourself so you can, like I said, education, employment.
Mm-hmm.
So we bring them to job fairs. We get them thinking about other forms of employment. And if they can't work at all, say they are disabled, they are on SSDI, we get them into volunteer stuff. They volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to get to sobriety is through connection. The worst thing you can do is isolate. So we find ways to connect them,
mm-hmm.
even if it's just volunteering. And then from there, they do phase three, and phase three is all about aftercare. So people tend to do, in here, they tend to do very well.
Mm-hmm.
But then they get out, and there's not the support they have
mm-hmm.
or the structure, and then it doesn't go so well. And then life hits you, and your girlfriend or boyfriend breaks up with you,
mm-hmm.
your parent passes away, someone dies, mm-hmm. car accident, lose the job, the volunteer place shuts down. All these things happen,
mm-hmm.
and there's no one around, or they don't know how to really deal with it yet,
mm-hmm.
Or they don't have the best skill set yet.
Mm-hmm.
So phase three is all about aftercare,
mm-hmm.
and it's about finding them housing, so an environment. So mm-hmm. it's about reconnecting, finding those social supports in the community. So
mm-hmm.
when you're away from here, how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
How do you give you those tools and housing? Housing's huge. You need to have independent housing. You can be the most compliant, adherent patient, and you can be the best worker in the world, but if you're coming home to an unsafe environment that has drug use, any type of substance use, neglect, you're being physically abused, sexually abused, there's no locks on the door, you can't make your rent,
mm-hmm.
the running water isn't always on, the heat's not always on,
mm-hmm.
you're sleeping in a bed with two other people, it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It does not work. You have to have a safe living environment, and it's extremely hard in the Northeast because they don't have first, they don't have last, they don't have the security deposit, they don't have credit, they might have a core, so good luck trying to find independent housing here. And by the way, hey, you want to move in with me because I'm a drug addict? No. No one who's a productive member of society, per se, is going to be like, yeah, go ahead, move right on in with that person. Everyone's going to be like, oh, they probably won't make rent, and there's all these issues that they're facing. So homelessness becomes a big issue. And then what does that look like? Well, then they start stealing things.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does incarceration look like, right? So there's all these things. Now you get the legal issues. How do you pay for those? And it's this domino effect. So aftercare is truly focused on housing and safe environment and finding that social support outside of here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to set them up. Phase four is for our individuals who really are having a hard time finding that housing. They have nothing. We have people who came here, they've never had a bank account. We help
mm-hmm.
them get a bank account. They have never saved money. It just wasn't in part of their normal life before. And so we have phase four is our graduate program.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more of transitional housing. And so they can stay there, you know, up to as how long they need, but we would hope you'd move on at one point from there. And they do. So we've got 22 single rooms and 24 other beds that are in a shared triple decker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a community. Because we've also found that a therapeutic model, when you are in a therapeutic community, it's very, very important within the first year or 2 years of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
When you isolate, when you get overwhelmed,
mm-hmm.
human nature is typically, no matter what it is, to revert back to what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how humans are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, And then you throw in addiction where your mind fools you.
Yeah.
So we have that transitional housing where they pay their, a nominal fee based on their income. It's a membership fee, and they get social support services and clinical services in the house. But it's for a time for them to save that money. Maybe it's they got to save $2,000. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe they need a car, too. And who knows? And maybe they need all these things. So they save the money, and it's enough for them to get on their feet mm-hmm. to really live independently on their own, because the worst thing to do would be able to rush it. Wow. So think about doing it so well and then failing again.
Mm-hmm.
And by failing, that's what they call it. Some people call it relapse. Mm-hmm. Other people, if you look at it a chronic condition, it's a recurrence of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And then people are like, well, I guess you didn't learn. Or they are like, I didn't learn. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of shame and guilt. Now you throw that into the mix of the mental health component.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really try to make sure that they're strong enough to handle it independently. And they need to be part of it. But also can't be one of those things where we're telling them, well, you're not ready, you're not right. Mm-hmm. No. This is them. They define their treatment plan, and this is us just, being the cheerleader on the side.
Mm-hmm.
We can't tell them what's best for them. That's pretty much how we got into a lot of problems and a lot of social problems in world history, right?
Yeah.
Are people telling us that this is the way we should think, this is the way you should do things. I mean, that is how whole countries have gotten in trouble
mm-hmm.
With things. So we can't do that either.
LEAP sounds amazing. Your last point then brings me to a conversation we had previously about just trying to stop the opioid epidemic by taking away the drugs themselves. Do you mind elaborating on, one, how that fails, but at the same time, two, what we are doing that will lead to hopefully a recovery from the opioid epidemic itself?
So my philosophy, and this is based on, my own education and my own continuing education, and also my experiences in the field.
Mm-hmm.
So I know some people might disagree with it, but there is a lot of evidence to back it. You could take away, the substance itself is not the sole determinant or exclusive reason for the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, like I think we had said before, I could fill an auditorium and I could put a bottle of water in front of everybody and then be like, surprise, it's actually vodka, and not all 100 people in that room are going to become alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
And the way, if you think about it even further than that, there was the Bruce Alexander. He was a very famous professor in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he did an experiment with rats. And he put a rat in a cage with two water bottles. One was clean water. One was drug-laced water.
Mm-hmm.
And what he found is, time and time again, the rat would go to the drug-laced water and drink it until they eventually overdosed and died,
mm-hmm.
killed themselves. And then he had a second cage. The second cage was called Rat Park. It was a big cage, lots of wheels, food, lots of other rats. It was rat heaven,
mm-hmm.
Where they could, eat, drink, be merry, have sex, all the things that animals would want to do. And he had the same thing, two water bottles. One was clean and one was drug-laced. And what he saw is, in that environment, the rats would go to the clean water.
Mm-hmm.
So then he took it one step further, and he took a rat who was actively withdrawing, so right before the rat would die, who was in the isolated cage,
mm-hmm.
who was already addicted to drugs, took that rat and put that rat in Rat Park.
Mm-hmm.
You would see what would happen. And what we saw is the vast majority of the time that the addicted rat would actually go through withdrawals
mm-hmm.
and end up drinking the clean water
mm-hmm.
and integrate back into society. It's very important for us to look at our environmental factors and
mm-hmm.
how that we do know, the World Health Organization tells us that 80% of our health around that is based on social and environmental, what you eat, drink, where you play, all of those things, socioeconomics, and how those are determinants of health, and then your genetics is, at least, you know, another 20% or so. But even if you're more scientific, if people are like, okay, well, we're not rats, we're humans, I've always said my own personal thing is, okay, because we did all the petri dishes in pharmacy school. I remember that. Petri dish. I got three petri dishes. Yeah. Same exact molecule in each dish, right? I put one in heat. I leave one at room temperature. I put one in the freezer. Three very, very different outcomes. That molecule is not going to be the same. So it shows you that even genetically, on a genetic basis, you put the same exact thing, three different environments, and you're going to get three very different outcomes, which is why taking the drug or the substance, taking that away, isn't going to solve the problem. Now, do I think there should be laws with drugs? Of course. There always has to be a happy medium. We cannot go on either. We cannot go to the extremes. But what we need to do is also work on the other side of that. Because taking the drug away doesn't solve and does not look at the underlying problem. What is this drug or substance giving the person that they're not getting out of life? Not what are they using, but why are they using it? Not what is wrong with it, but what is right with it? What are they getting out of this that's working for them? And when you're able to figure that out, then you get to work on the hard stuff. And I think that the best way to show this is, you know, in the midst of this opioid epidemic, now we have people who drug of choice is an opioid, whether it was, you know, OxyContin or Percocet or Vicodin, then they went to heroin. And now they're saying, my second drug of choice, it was always, you know, OxyContin or Percocet, the prescription drugs, and then heroin or benzo, or it was usually always a CNS depressant, kind of went in that theme. And now we're seeing first drug of choice heroin, second drug of choice is meth. Two very different highs, meaning you can take all that heroin away and they will they're now moving on to a different drug. And the reason that you're seeing this is the advent of fentanyl. So people are afraid to use heroin. It is laced with the fentanyl, and that they don't want to die. But they don't want to experience this reality or whatever they're experiencing, whether it's emotional, physical pain, whatever it is. So they'll move on to the next thing. So if you keep removing it, you can remove everything. I mean, look, it's the same thing as food addicts. What are you going to do, remove food? No, you're not going to do that. There's people who are addicted to, you know, sex, shopping. You know, if you remove all those things, you don't deal with the underlying issues. So you can't just say creating a really strict laws or the war on drugs will solve it. Because the war on drugs didn't solve anything. I think we all know that by now. But we need to take the money that we put into war on drugs, and we can, we must continue to have a civilized society. We must continue to have laws and hold people accountable. You know, I think they're doing a really awesome job in Boston about doing that. I could speak about my outrage to the Boston police after us if you want, but the other side of it is that you have to take that money, you have to put it into education, and you have to put it into, you have to put it into the other things, teaching people how to deal with self-esteem, purpose, all those things. You have to deal with the mental health, the behavioral health, even the physical health part. You got to deal with the health side. Can't remove it and not deal with this other side. There's the other half. It only goes halfway, so. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I like those two analogies because it really gives our listeners a little bit of perspective as to how to view this. Especially if you know, I think a few of our listeners are family members, concerned family members.
Absolutely.
And it's sometimes hard to understand from perhaps, you know, an outside perspective in a sense where if you're so disconnected with someone who is going through all this, it's very hard to understand to be empathetic. So I think those two analogies really drive it home as to what we're looking at here. I think if there is one last question that I want to ask. So there is this huge, and feel free to answer in whatever way you'd like, or not answer at all, but there is this very controversial, you know, chit-chat about who's at fault here.
Who's at fault
here? Because you're doing all of this amazing work, based off of what you have seen, and there is a personal side to it.
Mm-hmm.
But with everything that you're doing and all these people that you're helping, you know, even me just listening to your story and listening to all these stories, you have a twinge of why did this even happen in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So, looking forward into, okay, where is this going? Hopefully, you know, ideally when you want to help everyone that needs help and finish that work, we would go then look back on this and say, okay, how did this even happen, and how are we preventing it next time?
So, I love the question, first of all, but the answer, I know most people be like, oh, you don't want to answer the question. So I think that question is extremely important to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
I think the answer to it is completely unproductive to even talk about, because by trying to place fault, we're not helping anybody now.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts people on the defense. I think society as a whole is at fault. The individual person, you know, they made choices in their life that you could say at some point, so they made one choice at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it wasn't even the drugs, but something in it that maybe they acted after they were on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's personal fault, sure. Mm-hmm. Or even the personal fault of, could you have gotten into treatment sooner?
Mm-hmm.
Could you have asked for help sooner?
Mm-hmm.
Not maybe even just the choice. I'm not even talking about just the choice of to use drugs, because
mm-hmm.
it wasn't your choice to be traumatized, but it is your responsibility to get better. That's what I always tell my guys. It's not your fault what happened to you, but it is your responsibility to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I would say to apply it to all of society. It's, you know, at this point, everyone, there's fault and blame that can be passed around.
Mm-hmm.
There are some from the medical field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. There's doctors that have talked about it. There's doctors that are in jail. There's people that misprescribed, right? There's still people that misprescribed. And there's pharmacists that, then they're like, well, the pharmacist shouldn't have dispensed it. Yeah, sure. There was tons of pills that went out that they probably, you know, but then you have the regulatory agencies. Maybe they shouldn't have approved the drug in the first place. Or maybe we should, when we look at the drug distributors, now Cardinal and McKesson, they're all getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a little piece of this,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think the best way to look at it is don't look at anybody else. Look at yourself and look at how what you could have done in your field, in your position, even in your own home.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do to prevent it?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a teacher, educate people
mm-hmm.
about the risks or where to get resources. If you're a doctor, go through the side effects. Go through what is the actual physical dependence risk.
Mm-hmm.
What are the options if that doesn't work? What are the alternatives? Give them the full spectrum of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
If you are the pharmacist, counsel them on you know, on the drug. If you're a family member, talk to them. If you're a regulatory agency, create the thresholds that at one point is a red flag. And that red flag doesn't mean absolutely cut off that line of distribution, but it means, hey, maybe look at this.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe there's something going on. We live in a very big country. Maybe there's something going on there that's a different type of health crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that, you know, I do know one thing. I don't think Americans experience pain any different than people in Europe or Asia or anywhere else. But, you know, if something's going on in this country and all of a sudden a bunch of pain pills are going out in a certain place, maybe look, is that a community where there's people who are more prone to accidents? Is it an older population where they are prone to falls? Look at all these things. Look at the public health around it and look at what you can do, because it's every single person has a part, you know. And I think going back and trying to assign blame is going to be unproductive. I think the only way to do is to go back, learn from history, and take a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
Or put up the safeguards to say, hey, if this is happening, this is a point for intervention and to reevaluate what's going on. And I think you've got to do that in your personal life and in your professional life. You've got to be able to do that for the people around you and for the people who we work with. And that's really, I think, the only way that we can do it. I think we need to look at ourselves as a society and really pick it up, because it is affecting us as a society across the board.
Very well said. Thank you so much, Dr. Ali Burns. Dr. Ali Burns is the president and CEO of Hope House Addiction Services and the president of End Mass Overdose. And thank you so much for being on today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I think that should be it.
Okay, awesome.